They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shuba.
Fairfax Radio, we've got a new name, but it's still the same great programming and my wonderful guests. And today we're joined by Dr. Evan McKenzie. Evan, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Shu, anytime.
Well, you've got a new book coming up. We've all been waiting for a follow-up to Privatopia, and it's here, finally.
Yep, just came out.
And I haven't got my copy yet, it's on order, but can you tell us a little bit about it? I feel a little lost because I can't really talk to you about the book.
Okay, that's not a problem. Well, it's called Beyond Privatopia, Rethinking Residential Private Government, and it's published by Urban Institute Press in Washington, D.C. And I put up on my blog on privatopia.blogspot.com a link to it so that you can buy the book from the publisher. Actually, the only reliable way to buy it right now is from the publisher because it's just come off the presses in the last few days, and I don't think Amazon or Barnes & Noble actually have any in stock. So if you want it, the way to get it is to use the link and go straight to Urban Institute Press.
Okay.
And buy it directly from them.
And it's on privatopia.blogspot.com, and they can go there.
Yeah, that's my weblog, and I just posted a link, a direct link that you can click. It takes you right to Urban Institute Press, and right up on the book, and it's the order page.
Cool. So tell us a little bit about the book. Like I said, we've all been waiting for
right.
the follow-up on Privatopia.
Sure. Well,
and Privatopia came out when, in 1992? 94. Okay.
Well, most people don't know this, but I've written a lot about this subject since then. I just wasn't in book form, so a lot of the people who just buy books and don't read or buy, subscribe to academic journals wouldn't know. But I've written a lot of book chapters and journal articles on this topic that have been in various books published in around the world, in Europe and so forth, and I've written journal articles for various journals in this country and elsewhere about this topic. So I'd done a lot of thinking, and my views on a lot of things had changed over time. And so I finally decided to put some of the new ideas together in a book, and it's not, everything in the book is new. It's not that it's not a collection of articles. It's a book, but I'd thought a lot of things through and seen a lot of things differently. And when I wrote Privatopia, it seemed to me, and I think it was true actually, that the driving force behind common interest housing really was real estate developers, and that they were a form of privatization that was very convenient and very lucrative for real estate developers. And I explained how and why that practice evolved over time, really starting in the 1800s and then accelerating certainly after the 1960s. As land got scarce, suburban land got scarce, and they began to try to increase density. But what happened was, in the years after the book came out, I was going around giving talks here and there at the National League of Cities and various places and reading what was happening. It became obvious to me that the driving force really was not just the developers, that increasingly municipalities were very enthusiastic about this type of housing. So, and that is what I think that was the first thing that really caused me to start thinking that this was evolving, this phenomenon was evolving in a different way. Because I had thought, and a lot of libertarians had thought, that you should view common interest housing developments as a competitor with municipalities. Makes perfect sense. And in this new book, I talk a lot about that perspective. I have a whole chapter on that perspective. It's not that it's wrong. It's just that there's a lot, it's more complicated because it's not just that they're competing with municipalities. Municipalities have responded, and counties have responded to the spread of common interest housing by, in a sense, embracing it in a number of places, and even requiring it. And I know your listeners are very familiar with this, but you have to look at the whole phenomenon differently. I mean, if it's a competitor, then why are cities telling developers, we don't want you to build anything else? You have to build this way. We demand it. We insist on it. And so I began to write about this, and I've been saying this for years and years. It's not something I just said in this book. I've been saying it in these articles and so forth for you know, a long time, that this has become a part of the structure of local government. This type of housing has been built into the structure of local government. And so you have to look at it differently. It's not a question of replacing municipalities. Municipalities are forming, a lot of them, a much more structured relationship with these private developments, and they're using them in certain ways. So the basic argument that I made in this book is I can summarize it pretty quick, I guess. It's not too complicated. That first, that common interest housing developments aren't really private and they aren't really public and they don't really fit neatly into any institutional sector at all. So all these theories, such as the libertarian theories, the neoclassical economics theories, the rational choice theories that say they're private, they insist over and over they're private, that's just a fundamental error. They simply are not private. They are not private entities and not in any sense. But they're not completely public either. They're not fully governmental. They're in between, and that's just the way we have to accept that. They're a hybrid institution that has a lot of ambiguity. Second, I do not believe that common interest housing developments are in the process of replacing municipalities, which Robert Nelson argues, and a lot of libertarians have argued, that they're going to replace cities with... in some areas where there really aren't existing cities, places like areas where they've put subdivisions in the desert and this sort of thing, there aren't any municipalities, sure. But the idea that private government is going to completely replace municipal governance is I just fundamentally wrong, in my opinion. That's not actually what's happening at all. The local government policy toward these things has shifted. Initially, there was skepticism. Now they're promoting them. Cities can benefit fiscally from forcing the new residential development into these private communities. And we've talked a lot about that over the years, Sue, but, they're getting a huge tax windfall. These are cash cows. And that's the expression that a city manager used when I discussed this some years back. He says they're cash cows.
Yeah.
They're just flat cash cows. They're making money off it. So to say that they're putting them out of business is just simply not the way it's going. They're embracing them. And then, so what is it? How would you look at it? Well, I would say there's kind of an institutional convergence going on where increasingly the common interest housing developments are becoming more governmental in their powers and I think also in the way they're being regulated, rather being regulated in some states more as if they were governmental. And local governments are increasingly taking on a lot of the attributes of private corporations. I mean, they're actually emulating gated communities in many cases. We have cities or residential neighborhoods trying to practice the exclusive tactics and the gating and that sort of thing, and the surveillance tactics, putting up surveillance cameras on every entrance into the town, mm-hmm. on public streets.
Yes.
Well, they're emulating gated communities in order to enhance their attractiveness to people who think that sort of thing is good for property values or who are afraid of other people. And then at the same time, state legislatures across the nation have always practiced this kind of laissez-faire attitude until recently toward common interest housing developments. You made a deal and you're stuck with the deal you made with the developer.
Right.
And everything's civil and don't talk to us about criminal law violations, even if they're robbing you blind, because this is all civil and Yeah, you agreed to everything.
Right.
Well, a lot of state legislatures have shifted away from that. They're taking a much harsher, much harder look at common interest housing developments, and that's in part because there's just the relentless push they're getting from the press and from interest from the Pink Flamingo groups and so forth, who are exposing the things that have been going on in these developments, the outrages that have taken place with these amateur governments, and in some cases corrupt activities going on, theft of money and all sorts of other things. Well, this is getting into the press again and again and again, and so politicians eventually, it's like water dripping on a rock, eventually it begins to make a dent in these people, and they eventually begin to say, to change their perception and to see there really is a systemic problem. It isn't just isolated instances, and that was always the argument. When my first book came out, CAI and these other people running around saying, oh, well, he just listed 20 or 30 specific instances of misconduct. Well, okay, I could list 200 or 300
Yeah.
And they'd say the same thing. Or 2,000 or 3,000 and they'd say the same thing. It's going on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And I think state legislatures have begun to get the picture. I mean, some of them are bought and paid for by various industries, but the point is at least some legislators understand this. So in a number of states like Florida and California, to some extent Arizona, maybe even places like Texas, New Jersey, there's around the country, even Illinois, there's a steady push toward increased regulation. That's clearly the direction we're going in. We're not going in the opposite direction of less regulation that the libertarians want us to go in. It's going in the direction of more regulation. And if you look at the quality, at the nature of the regulations that come from these state legislatures, they're treating these associations more as if they were governmental in terms of exposure of their records and open meetings and fair elections and this sort of thing. So that's why I talk about convergence. So that's the direction that public policy and private action seem to be taking. However, the other major point that I think needs to be made here is that the fragility of this entire institution, because as I've said, I know to you a number of times, Shu, I keep using this analogy, this whole institution is like a pyramid that's turned upside down and balanced on the point.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything comes down to the individual owner. At the bottom of the pyramid, the point of this pyramid that's standing on its tip, that little tip that everything depends upon is the individual owner. And everything else, the securitization of mortgages, the provision of public services, all these things that are happening, this huge array of functions that are supposed to be performed by and through these associations and the residents through the payment of their mortgages and their assessments, all this stuff, it all rests on the individual owner. And it rests on their financial resources, paying their assessments. It rests on their willingness to accept this constrained type of living as opposed to just, fighting and suing and having to be forced into compliance. It depends upon and assumes they will be loyal to their association, loyal to their community. It assumes they'll volunteer and want to serve on the board, And it assumes, as Tyler Birding has pointed out, who I think is really a very sharp guy, that there's a fundamental flaw here, which is that you can trust people to adequately fund the association today in order to reconstruct roofs and so forth in 20 years. Well, when you look at the financial situation that people are in this country right now, that isn't a realistic assumption at all, to assume that today we'll call in or an actuary or somebody and do a reserve study and jack our assessments way up so somebody else we don't even know can buy a roof in 20 years or repave the streets in 10 years. I mean, this is a fundamental flaw. These associations are, in my opinion, almost invariably under-reserved. There are not adequate resources either in money or in time or in energy or in loyalty or dedication or volunteerism to keep them running. And moreover, the expertise gap, which we've talked about again and again, is huge.
Yeah.
The government just keeps government at all levels keeps encouraging and creating these little private governments, forces owners to run them for nothing, and then doesn't do anything to train them and doesn't do anything except in a very few states to help them resolve their quarrels, and they're supposed to go off and spend $200,000 in 7 years of civil litigation to get access to their records or to get their assessments set correctly or to have open meetings or the simplest thing. Well, this is completely unsustainable. This way of doing things is, in fact, unsustainable. Not just, I don't mean ecologically, I mean in human terms. It's unsustainable.
I agree.
And I think anyone should be able to see that, but that's the big picture. And so what I'm trying to say is that, this institution ultimately is part of a whole trend in our society. There's been this battle that's been going on certainly since the time of the New Deal between government and the private sector, government trying to regulate activities of the private sector, and big corporations trying to get their freedom from government by any means that they can possibly come up with, offshoring jobs, moving their income stream to the Bahamas, all these things, anything to get out from under government control. And one of those major efforts is privatization. I mean, the recent effort by the Republicans, the vote by the Republicans in the House of Representatives, they actually voted to privatize Medicare, turn it into a voucher program. They actually voted, a majority of people in the House of Representatives voted to do that. And now they're trying to pretend they didn't, but they did. Well, this whole privatization movement that's been going on since Margaret Thatcher is one of these attempts by corporations to get out from under government, to get out from democratic control, you know, to operate according to the rules of the marketplace and free of the voters, free of interference from any government or any kind of oversight. And this type of housing is a significant part of that whole movement. So it's not, you know, we tend to look at it in isolation. It's not. It's part of something much, much larger. And in all these issues, these privatization debates that go on, whether it be the parking meters in Chicago, the tollways, and on, all these things that are proposals to privatize, vouchers for schools and Medicare and everything, it always comes down to certain key points. And I think the same points prevail here, which is, if you want a thing done, how does the government retain, and we're going to try to save money in doing it by having some contractor do it, how does the government maintain accountability to public standards?
And they don't.
That's the whole problem, ultimately. It's the problem with many forms of privatization is inadequate government-insured accountability. And that's what has to be done, I think. If it isn't done, if a government don't take some responsibility for the training and the conflict resolution and the criminality and the other things that are going on, if they don't, well, I don't think there's any fix for the housing market generally. I don't think that this institution that we have is common interest housing is particularly viable in the long run. And you can look at the number of projects that are in trouble around the country. And there are many, many, many of them. They're in huge trouble.
And they keep growing daily.
Yeah. You know, they may, just because the local newspapers rarely talk about it. By the way, they do here in Chicago. We've had a number of articles on distressed condo projects.
Oh yeah.
In the Chicago Tribune. It's only beginning, I would argue. I think this is only beginning.
Well, I think this whole privatization, going back to what you were talking about a minute ago, they're not only just privatizing housing in residential areas, but actually city streets.
Yes.
There was a whole article, a whole nonsense thing that came up in Silver Spring because they discovered that the city of Silver Spring, Maryland, had actually leased or sold the downtown area to a private entity. And this private entity then decided that the tourists could not take photos there. They were confiscating cameras and, you know, threatening them because they were taking pictures. And all of a sudden, this whole thing came to light. It's like, wait a minute. But I had a friend, a very close friend who was an attorney, the attorney who litigated the Gilman case, and he used to say to me, Shu, and this was going back 20 plus years ago, he says, mark my words, all they're doing here is the local municipal governments are distancing themselves away from their constituents. They're becoming royalty. They don't want to deal with the hoi polloi. And he's absolutely true. I think of that quite often. I think of his words quite often. He says, you mark my words, that's where we're headed.
Well, I think that may be where they think they're headed. you know, my view of this is that on the one hand, it's like two lines. One of the lines is this direction you're describing, where there's an institutional convergence going on, or these municipalities and these officials who think that this approach to development is so clever because they can keep making the government bigger. They can keep increasing the size of government. They can keep generating revenues, despite the fact that they're getting all these signals from people that they're overtaxed, that they don't have any money, that they don't want anything, that they want certain services cut or whatever it is. They can keep doing this. They can keep, and I think of it as an extension of local government, basically. They can keep extending local government, extending social control by working out these weird relationships with private governments that do a lot of this stuff for them, collect revenues and all this. Okay, so on the one hand, you have this line going ahead. If you projected that line ahead, you'd say, well, this is just going to continue forever. But nothing in human affairs ever goes in a linear fashion. It's the way it seems to me. It never works that way. And there's another line. And that other line is the impending, the increasing dysfunction and insolvency in these associations. I mean, the strategy of these local governments in places like out west in Arizona and these places where they're heavily, heavily relying and pushing this type of housing. Chicago, too, in the redevelopment areas of Chicago. It all depends on these associations continuing to function. And I think that's why there has been increased regulation, because belatedly, state legislatures are beginning to catch on. In part, it's a concern about consumer protection, a legitimate concern. There's also a concern about the institution collapsing. And that's one reason why they want to regulate them, because they're starting to realize, I think, that this they can't assume that these institutions will continue to function. So, like here in Illinois, they recently passed a law. The state legislature passed a law called the Distressed Condominium Act, Distressed Condominium Property Act, it's called, because they had so many condo developments that were basically blighted. In some cases, there were all kinds of things that happened, Shu. I mean, we had a lot of projects that where people were selling units that didn't even exist. I mean, you'd have a building that had 12 units in it, and they'd sell 50.
Oh, jeez.
And the appraisers, and I've talked to appraisers about this. This is what was going on. Appraisers would drive by the building, and they wouldn't even go inside. They'd be appraising, you know, unit 32 in a 12-unit building.
Okay.
And they'd drive by the outside of the building, set an appraisal that would be sure that the sale would go through, and then go on. It didn't even exist.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Now, so we end up with all kinds of distressed condominium properties. And the way they define it is kind of vague, but basically they say it is a condominium parcel that contains condo units that are operated in a manner that might constitute a danger, blight, or a nuisance to the surrounding community. And then it lists a bunch of conditions, such as half or more of the units full of squatters, occupied by people who don't have a legal right to live there, 50% or more squatters.
Wow.
Serious building code violations, 60% or more of the units in foreclosure. There has been a recording of more units on the parcel than physically exist. That's what I was telling you about, you know. 12-unit building where they sold
30, number 40. 32, huh?
Yeah, exactly. The utilities have been cut off to more than 40% of the units or something. 60% or more of the units are in delinquency on property taxes. Now, that's what they said, any two or more of those conditions. But you understand, this was so prevalent, conditions like that, were so prevalent, they actually passed a state law to address the problem. That's how many there were. Now, and so when that happens, if that is the case, the way it works is the municipality where the project exists can go to court, and they ask the court, in essence, to appoint a receiver to take over the property. And at that point, the receiver goes and investigates the situation and has all kinds of powers to do all sorts of things. But ultimately, the receiver can come back to the court and say that the court ought to declare that the place is no longer a condominium. And they say that all the people who own the units at that point are tenants in common. And then they, which means that, you know, when you're tenants in common, you don't have individual units anymore. I mean, in a condominium, you have your airspace, you have exclusive title to your airspace, and you have an undivided interest in the common area. Well, if they turn it into a tenancy in common, then everybody owns a share of everything. There are no individual units, and you have to create write a contract up to have the right to possess it. Because the main reason they're doing this is so they can sell it. And so the court then can dispose of the building. It's basically not a condo anymore. And now they can, the receiver can have all kinds of powers, can operate the property as an apartment building. They can ultimately do anything with it, collect rents, and all the things that a property owner can do. And ultimately they may sell the building. Once they've created this unity of ownership, they can just basically sell the building to a real estate syndicate, an apartment owner, something like that, and dispose of it. So basically eradicating it as a condominium. And the project that I'm working on now that I've got this book out, I'm about to start a sabbatical leave for one semester. I'll be on leave. And I'm going to be working on finding as many different solutions like this around the country as I can. What are the practices that are in place and that are being suggested or that are being considered for preventing catastrophe and doing away with dysfunctional developments, condo, townhome, and also HOAs. There are a number of things that have been proposed around the country. In fact, and there are different problems. It isn't just one problem. One of the problems, for example, that is really causing many associations to suffer is foreclosures. I know we've right. talked about that, and you've done shows on this, but
yeah.
this foreclosure situation has a solution, I think. There's a bill in Congress right now called the Right to Rent Act. The Right to Rent Act was written, the proposal originally came from an economist by the name of Dean Baker, and it is being introduced by Representative Raul Grijalva, who was a Democrat from Arizona. He introduced it back in 2010, and it died in committee. It died in Barney Frank's Financial Services Committee for some reason. I do not know why. It has been now reintroduced in the current session in 2011. Just a couple of weeks ago. And this is a law that would basically say as follows. If you are an owner and you are being foreclosed upon, when you get notice of foreclosure, you have 25 business days to go to court and petition to become a tenant. So instead of, basically surrender the deed. You'd give it what they call a deed in lieu of foreclosure. You would surrender your deed to the property. You'd say, okay, you're right. I can't afford to be a homeowner, which I think is a problem that a lot of people are facing right now. They can't afford to be a homeowner at all. You know, there's no way. This just can't work. So you would then become a tenant. You would have a right. The court could force the bank to allow you to become a tenant. So you'd pay, and they would have an independent party decide what the rent should be. It'd be fair market value rent. The bank would get the rent. You'd pay your rent to the bank for up to 5 years. And that way you would not be thrown out. The bank, of course, would then have to start paying the assessments to the association. And the property would not become vacant. The association would not be losing. Because what happens now is when banks foreclose, they often don't pay the assessments. They just refuse to pay the assessments. The property has changed hands, and it now is in the hands of an owner, which is a big bank, and they just refuse to pay the assessments. And they wait and try to get the person they sell it to eventually to pay them. But this is such a yeah. terrible situation, and this law is so simple. And I think it would really solve the problem of the blighted communities. The banks would be getting revenue. They wouldn't be holding the property and getting nothing on it. They'd be able to pay the taxes, pay the assessments. And then the owner would have a chance to continue living, keeping their kids in school, and not disrupting the whole community by getting thrown out on the street and their property put out on the sidewalk.
And as when we were talking about this yesterday, I asked you the magical question, what happens now that so many associations have amended their governing documents banning rentals?
Yeah, that whole idea is, that whole idea of banning renters, that to me is like something from this gilded age that we went through,
uh-huh.
you know, in the 90s, where when property values were going through the roof. That is an artifact of a bygone era. You know, that is absolutely that is really, really a big mistake. And I have talked with a whole lot of lawyers who practice in this field, who represent associations and everything else, and I haven't found anybody who thinks these days that those document amendments make a bit of sense. Banning renters, it makes absolutely no sense in this market.
But it was during the last economic downturn that they started to become popular that I became aware of, because people were renting their units out when they had to move and couldn't sell them because they were underwater. And so the associations decided they really didn't want all these tenants in here. They would rather have the vacant units, the foreclosed units, what have you. And they sold it to the homeowners, and the homeowners voted it in. And now it's, I think, coming back to bite them, but...
Well, it was a very popular document amendment. It always has been. Maybe, according to some people I've talked to, the most popular amendment that lawyers were being asked to draft, banning renters. But, you know, these days I think people view the whole thing very differently. They're much more concerned about vacancies. You know, it's a problem because the associations have to be, you know, legitimately concerned about who's living in the property. I don't think it's an illegitimate concern. I mean, I can understand them not wanting to be presiding over an association that's 90% renters. I can see why they'd not like that.
Oh, I can understand that as well, but yeah. All of a sudden it seems the remedy for the situation is to let the
right.
owners become tenants. Now,
yes.
technically,
right.
yeah.
Because the alternative is in today's market.
Right.
The alternative is empty units.
Right.
And that's much worse. And then you just have an empty unit and no assessments coming in. Whereas you could have, potentially, if this was structured correctly, you could have the same family living there that's been living in that house. They're just tenants instead of owners. The bank would be paying the assessments. The bank would be getting rents that would enable, a fair market rent that would enable them to pay it. And a local community would be getting their property taxes and on and on. I mean, this is one way to go here. But the current situation, where the banks have huge quantities of real estate that they have foreclosed on, these so-called REO, real estate-owned properties mm-hmm. that they have acquired, and they can't sell them, and they're dumping them on the market, thereby depressing property values, which then makes it impossible for people to refinance because they're underwater,
yeah.
and on and on. You know, this is a downward spiral that we're in here, and I think it's possible that, you know, one way to begin to turn this around and to make these communities more attractive instead of becoming blighted with vacancies and squatters and so forth, abandoned properties with windows broken out and the banks are paying no attention to, I mean, the one way to turn this around would be not to throw the owner out of their property. If you think about it, I mean, the whole mortgage industry has always been premised on the notion that if people lived in the home that they borrowed money to buy, they'd pay back the loan. Because they lived there. This was
yeah.
their home. It was not just an investment. It was their home. And what happened with this craziness that started in the mid-90s was this idea of turning the home in home ownership into a form of radical speculation.
Yeah.
And that is where the problem comes from. When people started speculating with buying houses they couldn't afford, thinking they were going to get rich, and it went on and on and on until the whole market collapsed. If we somehow get back to this notion, which is I think a valid notion, that people will pay back a loan if for a reasonable amount of money, a reasonable rate, to pay the mortgage on a home where they actually live, that actually is a wise investment. If we get back to that, you have a foundation for a restored market. But you've got to get the speculation of it, because that's the craziness.
Well, I think you've got to get people rethinking things. Right now, you know, it's an investment. And with associations, they'll tell you the reason you need an association is to protect property values. So property values has become the god that everybody seems to worship
right.
at this point.
Right.
And I think that whole notion has got to be changed around, and it's got to come down to pride of ownership and pride of home. Unfortunately, the whole design of the association mentality is counters that whole notion of having pride and being able to do anything in your home without having to get permission to do things. You know, you're not allowed to breathe.
Right.
People are getting written up because their kids' bikes are sitting in the front yard while they go into the bathroom or go in to
yeah.
get, you know, stupid, stupid stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. It's just crazy. Yeah, and even more fundamental than that, you know, many, many people in the post-World War II housing boom added value to their homes by, you know, putting on a room or constructing a porch or
right.
adding a pool. Now, and they would go to their local authorities, and there was a zoning code
right.
and a building code, and they'd comply with that, and they would go off and do it, and nobody bugged them.
Right.
Because they didn't have to go to their neighbors. Now, they have to go to their neighbors. And now it turns out your neighbor doesn't want you to have a pool, because it might make your house look better than his, or
right.
your neighbor doesn't want you to have a swing set. I mean, this just nutso craziness that goes on now, because we've devolved government power on people who don't know how to use it.
Or, you know, you're using the wrong shade of white, and you're going to devalue property values. And it's just because they don't like you or they don't want you to do something.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I've never really understood. You know, there's various explanations for why common interest housing evolved the way it did. But one of the things that I have never understood, and it's got to be some kind of a cultural thing, is this idea that many people have, that sameness, that uniformity in a community is good for property values. Because I don't think that's true. If you you look at more expense, if you go up the economic ladder to communities that are really worth a lot more money, where wealthier people live, at more expensive homeowner association developments, the homes are built differently. They're not the same. They're not the same. I've never been in a really upscale community. I've been in a lot of them, you know, driving around looking at them in various conferences and tours and this and that and the other, and I'm representing associations. If you look at the places where rich people live, they may never have a house the same as their neighbors.
No, they won't.
Now, why did people start thinking that if you're moving up into the middle class, you want a house exactly like your neighbors? I think it's just nonsense. It's a way of saving money on design and construction costs. That's all it is. And the idea that you have to stay like this forever is nuts.
Well, the thing is, it's dated. I mean, you go to places like Reston. Reston's one of the original big planned communities. And they had the color codes. And, you know, the stuff that the colors that they used in the 60s and the 70s, you guys remember the avocado greens and the browns?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're all over Reston. But the thing is, they're written into the covenant. So it looks dated. It looks old. It looks dated.
And even worse example of that is a few years ago, there was a terrible fire in the western part of the San Diego area. There were fires all over Southern California. It was a big fire season. And there were a number of homeowner association-run properties, or there are these deed restrictions in place, where houses were burned down. One of the reasons they burned was because they had shake roofs, or wood shingle roofs called shakes.
Yeah.
And so the owners got their insurance money, and they go back to reconstruct, and they find a different type of shingle, and along comes the association president and tells them, whoa.
You can't have that.
You can't do that. You've got to put wood shakes back on your roof.
Yeah, they do that all over the place.
Complete, it's just absolute insanity.
It
and,
is.
You know, I mean, you can understand why developers, during the build-out phase, and when they're controlling the association, you can understand for marketing reasons why they don't want people making big changes in anything. You can understand it because they're trying to sell these houses to people. They don't want anything to look different and odd and weird. I get that. I understand. I'm not sure that it necessarily makes sense, but fine, I understand. But for the owners to continue to oppress each other after they take over the association is really, really unfortunate and crazy.
You know, at one point, what the developers were doing in the governing documents, they were imposing these restrictions, and they said you couldn't make any changes for a period of so many years. And that was during their time when they were in the association and they were building. Once they left, that died and that was gone. That was no longer an issue. And now you could do, you know, you could change colors and you could change all that subject to, you know, to architectural control approval, but... And that's where the problems start.
Right. Well, again, you get, you know, the problems often occur when you move from a professional running things according to some idea of what they're trying to accomplish to turning it over to some cabal of people or one person with a bunch of strange ideas. And, you know, this is one of the fundamental problems of this type of housing. Often... And it happens in a condo. It's the difference between having a landlord and having a condo board. And in HOA, it's the difference between having, you know, a municipality or even a developer running it and your neighbors. I mean, that transition is such a risky one because of the lack of expertise and the lack of predictability in terms of what kind of people you're going to get. I mean, some associations have really, really nice people running them, and they get along just fine, and they have common sense, and they don't bug each other. I know people who live in such associations.
But you're one election away from having all of that change.
Right, and in almost every case, everyone says the same thing.
Yep.
In almost every development, there's only a small group of people who want to run things. And you have to hope that they're good people, because if they're not, you're in terrible, terrible trouble, and there's no remedy. So, you know, unless government... I don't know who else could do this. I mean, you can't. I don't believe that industries police themselves particularly well. I don't believe the real estate industry. I'm certainly not the property managers and the lawyers who are getting rich off the dysfunction. They're not going to solve the problems. There's just no way, and it's just never, ever, ever going to happen that they're going to solve the problems. I don't see who else can do it except state and local governments. I mean, unless the federal government wants to get involved, I don't think they're going to be very, you know, amenable to that. So it's really mostly matters of state law anyway. So the state governments have to get involved and try to first create regulations that require some sort of training and compliance with state standards. They've got to live up to public standards. And then secondly, there's got to be a way to hold people accountable for not doing it. There's got to be a low-cost dispute resolution mechanism. We've got to stop defaulting to the trial courts, the state trial courts. It's simply an unworkable way to do things. And I think everybody knows that, but that's what has to happen.
There's so many lawsuits going on right now, Evan. I hear from people all the time. They send me their cases. The stories that I'm not really allowed to talk about because they're in litigation will make your hair curl. And the things that the industry attorneys are doing at these, you know, in these associations is just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. I hear a lot of these stories too.
Yeah.
I heard one just the other day that just flat involves serious criminality.
Yeah.
And where people are actually afraid
mm-hmm.
of their association.
They're afraid of going home.
They're afraid. They're actually afraid. And probably for good reason, because what's going on is, in fact, criminality. And yet when it's brought to the attention of the state's attorney, they say, oh, this is a civil matter. Well, no. Actually, I mean, can you imagine if someone in your bank was stealing money from your account and you went to the state's attorney's office and they told you, oh, that's a civil matter. You could sue them for that. Well, yeah, I could sue them. It's also theft. How about that? You know?
I got an email today from someone in California saying that in California there's a law, that's a statute that says the association cannot foreclose until you've been overdue, you know, past due for your assessments by a year. And this person who wrote to me said that she'd missed three payments that amounted to somewhere in the neighborhood of $120. But she said she now owes over $3,000 because they've added all of these charges and things, and every time she tries to make the payments, they refuse to accept her check. She says they're running it up to the one-year mark so they can go ahead and foreclose.
Yeah.
You know, that's criminal. That is absolutely. And so many people tell me, you know, I've been trying to send these checks in, and they won't cash them. They'll just return them.
Oh, I've heard of many examples like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're just trying to run up the assessments. Yeah, and I mean, run up the fees and charges. But, you know, the only fix, I think, the only fix for this is legislation. I like to think that there would be some other way short of a state law to do this, but there doesn't seem to be. Either state or you get local prosecutors involved. But I think the answer has to be from government. And I'm not saying that there has to be a new regulatory agency, although I think the ombudsman idea has some merit, but there has to be standards, there has to be training, and there has to be a mechanism for getting people to live up to those standards. And I don't see where those will come from, except from state governments. Or it could be locality, and it could be municipalities, but you have to have standards, you have to educate people about those standards, and there has to be a mechanism for holding them to those standards. And right now, I think we have a lot of work to do on all three of those counts.
I think there needs to be enforcement. There's no place for the homeowner to go. We have an ombudsman. Ombudsman's not there for that. The ombudsman's there in case you get a proxy in the mail and you don't know what it is, so you call the ombudsman and you say, I got this proxy in the mail. What do I do with it? That's what the ombudsman's there for. It's costing us a lot of money to have this huge panel of people sitting there. But that's the only thing the ombudsman's entitled to do, allowed to do. You know, yeah. There has to be some real enforcement someplace.
Yeah. No, I agree. This has been a problem for a very long time, and it continues to be. It's a very, very serious problem. But, you know, the funny part is, you know, the municipalities that are promoting all this and going along with it, they seem to feel they can continue to wash their hands of all the problems. They seem to feel. But there's a point where, and I think it's happening, I think it's actually beginning to happen with all these foreclosures and people walking away and abandoned properties. There's a point where the problems become problems for local government. And I don't know that's why I think the situation is not really sustainable. There's a point where the discontent becomes a problem. For example, you see judges getting, I've heard judges say things like, another one of these cases with these associations, and why can't you people get along with each other?
Yeah.
Listen to a judge raving about that in a case I was involved with. You know, another one of these cases, why do I keep getting these cases? Well, you know, do you have half an hour? I'll be glad to explain it to you, you know. You're going to get a lot more.
Why don't you get along? I love that one. I've heard that one from a number of different judges. Why can't you people just get along?
Yeah, why can't you just get along? Well, how about because they're throwing people out of their homes, they're stealing from them, they're running banana republic elections. You know, how about that? People are supposed to put up with that? The thing is, you know, some judges can be educated about these issues over the course of a case and can begin to understand what's going on, but I just think, you know, over time, it's, like I said, like water dripping on a stone. Over time, government officials at all levels are getting more and more educated about this, and the direction is, I think, toward more regulation rather than less. And it may take a long time, but that's where we're headed.
In Virginia, they are, you know, enacting legislation. However, they're getting all their information from CAI. So the legislation that's coming out is not necessarily consumer or homeowner friendly.
Yeah.
It just increases the powers of the association and the industry.
Well, but you see, Shu, then we get back. That's true. But look, what are they supposed to do? If they are going to hear from anyone other than the industry, someone has to be organized and fund a group to counter what the industry is going to say. There is nothing wrong with a trade association trying to influence government. It is perfectly legal. There's nothing wrong with it.
I agree.
And this whole bad guy theory that people keep espousing, it's terrible that CAI does this. No, it isn't. They're taking dues from their members to do this. It's protected by the First Amendment. It's called petitioning the government for redress of grievances. It is protected interest group activity. That's what they're supposed to do. That doesn't mean they're supposed to win, but they're supposed to try to influence the government. And the consumers, who are on the other side, they're supposed to get organized, and they're supposed to present a different picture, and they're supposed to try to influence these legislators. And if they won't do it, then guess what? They're going to lose.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
I mean, it's totally predictable that CAI is going to do this. Of course, they're a trade association. What do you expect them to do?
No, I understand, but all the legislation that you talk about, the regulations that are coming and that are being put in place, but the regulations, a lot of the regulations that I see either have no teeth in them, you still have to go to court, or they increase the powers of the association because the homeowners are not organized. And you're
not,
absolutely true.
If they're not at the table and they don't have proposals, they don't have realistic proposals, and they can't talk the language of public policy, they're going to get steamrolled, and the laws that come out will be toothless or worse.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah, it certainly, and this is a state-by-state battle, but you have to be organized, I think, like CAI is organized. If you look how they're set up, they are set up to function as local chapters and then to draw from those local chapters to create state political action committees. See, so they have these local chapters of one organization all around the various parts of the state, you know, and then they create a legislative action committee for each state, and they draw people from those local chapters who serve in these legislative action committees, who function as their in-house lobbyists, basically. They also hire professional lobbyists as well. And then they have also a national organization that tries to keep everything kind of coherent on a national basis and keep it all together. So it's basically one organization with a lot of chapters and state-level organization for its legislative action committee. Well, how are the consumers organized? How are the owners organized? And the answer is...
They're not.
They're not well organized. There are a lot of small organizations, some that have been very effective at times, very effective at times in certain states.
Yeah.
But they're not unified. And you and I have talked about this a number of times. You know, somehow there's got to be more unity. And all this backbiting and backstabbing and credit claiming and... you know, kicking people off the other people's message boards.
I know.
And, you know, people get mad every time I say anything or write anything. Somebody comes out and starts accusing me of being some industry stooge because I don't want to run around proclaiming that all the associations in the country should be abolished tomorrow. You know, if this is the level of discourse that critics are going to have, if this is the level of it, then of course the industry is going to win.
Yeah. Right now you've got some, as you pointed out, you've got some groups that are very effective. I think one of the big disadvantages that we face is that we're homeowners. We're not professionals.
Right.
And what we need is a group. You need to hire professionals so that you can fight fire with fire. And what we have right now is just, you know, a group of hoi polloi. I mean, well-meaning, they're upset and they're willing to put in the work, but we're not dealing on an equal footing. There's always an imbalance here.
Oh, that's right. And this is always the problem with consumers, that the producer interests are always better organized than the consumer interests, because the producer interests have more of an individual stake. The average attorney or property manager, because they make their living this way, they have a huge personal economic stake in whatever comes from the policy process. Whereas each individual owner, if you look at the size of their individual stake, in most cases they say, well, geez, you know, why should I spend $50 a year on dues or $20 to go to this educational program, or why should I buy this book or whatever? Because really, you know, my stake in it isn't that big, and they'll...
Right.
You know, and so consumers tend not to be organized. But as we have discussed before, there are ways of getting around that. And I think, you know, if people were to set aside some of their differences and their egos...
That's the big one, is the egos, isn't it?
It is, because we have a whole lot of people who want to be, who think that their take on it is the authoritative one.
Yep.
And everybody else is a traitor for not subscribing to their theory, and on and on and on. And particularly people who get involved in the policy process, which does not lend itself to radical solutions ever. And so if you do get involved in the policy process, you're in the realm of incrementalism and compromise. And as soon as you do that, all these zealots come out of the woodwork and start screaming about how you're a terrible sellout. The minute you try to make any incremental progress at all to try to improve the situation, it's just like an SDS meeting from the 1960s. You know, where as soon as somebody said, well, you know, maybe we could get this from the administration, suddenly you've got some Marxists screaming at you for being the tool of everything the system stands for. You know, we're going to burn it all down. These pseudo-revolutionaries who sit around and insult everybody, they go straight to insults and vilification, you know, at the drop of a hat. This is what is the death of any kind of progress at all with these people. They will not allow anyone to make any progress. They got to squelch it and get on their self-righteous horse and start denouncing people. And, you know, that's, where does that leave us?
Where we are with
CAI
where
and other trade associations and other insurance companies and banks running the policy process and deciding how people are going to live. So congratulations, you've succeeded in stopping it, you know? That's basically, that's one of the things that has to be overcome if the owners are going to get organized, is they've got to get people to think in terms of what can actually be accomplished.
Maybe the idea is to have, the solution is to hire professionals. And you're not going to be happy with everything, but people whose full-time job it is to do that, as opposed to doing it on weekends and after dinner, after homework, and the dishes are done.
Yeah, but that's true, Shu. But then what will happen when you hire that professional? The professional lobbyist will come to you and say, okay, look, here's how much we can actually get. Here's something. Here's a realistic goal. And if you have in the group that has hired this professional someone who is convinced that the whole institution has to be abolished, and would be, is perfectly content to continue saying that for the next 20 years, even though it never happens, you know, the lobbyist is at some point going to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't get you that.
That
cannot be done.
Can't abolish it today, but for now, this is what we're going to do. Evan, thank
right.
you so much. Would you believe we're out of time?
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but we can do it again maybe when you have a copy of the book in your hand.
Is that a promise?
Sure. You can tell me where I went wrong.
Okay. And the book is called Beyond Privatopia, Rethinking Residential Private Government. I can't wait to read it.
Right. Urban Institute Press. And if people want to get the link, it's right at privatopia.blogspot.com.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Thank you, Shu. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Oh, I hope so. Thanks. Bye. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.